most important thing for me is the flattening of the curve in terms of the rate of missile launches by Iran. Frankly, I'm also scared of finding out just how many Tomahawks or JASMs and other long-range strike weapons that we've expended. How do we get at least some greater degree of interoperability between and among countries that, and this is not unique to the Middle East, but between and among countries that don't trust each other?
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and this is sort of a special bonus episode. We recently released an episode featuring three discussions about three strategic perspectives on the U.S.-Israeli strikes against Iran and the ongoing conflict that has spilled over into the region. If you haven't heard it, I highly recommend checking it out because I was joined by three really insightful guests. This episode complements those discussions, but it looks at the conflict from a different angle. Specifically, we're talking about its hardware dimension, and I'm joined for the discussion by another deeply insightful expert guest. What weapons are the United States and Israel using to strike Iran? What about the drones and missiles that Iran is using to strike regionally in response? And what about the air and missile defense component of the conflict? To explore those questions, I invited Tom Carrico back on the podcast. He is the director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and if you're a regular listener, you'll have heard him on the podcast before, talking about everything from air defense to hypersonic missiles. Before we get to the discussion about the weapons that are defining this conflict, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Tom Carrico. Tom, thanks so much for joining me and welcome back to the MWI podcast.
It's great to be back.
As I mentioned to you when I invited you on, I had the chance to talk to three really smart people recently about the strategic perspectives of the various parties to the ongoing conflict in Iran, parties that are both central to it, as well as those that are slightly more peripheral in the region. It was fascinating to talk to them, you know, but I guess I kept thinking I'd like to complement those discussions with a slightly more hardware-centric one. You, of course, were the first person whose expertise I sought out. You've been kind enough to fit me into what I know is a very busy schedule for you at the moment. But I guess if we just sort of jump right in, I wonder, as you've kind of watched over the past handful of days, if there are weapon systems on both sides of this conflict that you'd say are sort of maybe defining features of it, at least so far.
Yeah, well, look, I would say in terms of platforms and projectiles, you know, a handful of things obviously come to mind. Number one, the historic sinking of the ship by a submarine, which hasn't been done in a while. You know, and I think, you know, frankly, that of course, the broad effort to get after the missile program. You know, of all the many explanations of what seems to be going on here, of what our, frankly, objectives are, I think the statements by Hegseth and Kane were solid, but I really appreciated the comment by Marco Rubio right after he met with the Gang of Eight, and he walked out and he kind of explained to some critical questions the felt urgency for getting after the missile program, for getting after it and solving it once and for all. And, you know, last summer in the 12-day war, hundreds and hundreds of missiles and hundreds of drones were launched. And among other things, it really ate up a big piece of our missile defense interceptors. And that, I think, really further spooked people about this, that the threshold for use for these things had gotten so low. But really, these are strategic assets, and they were just being chewed up by Iran. And so when he said that Iran is producing 100 missiles a month and we're producing a very small number of interceptors per month, you see that time is not on our side, and that neither we nor the Israelis can really afford to keep doing this, to kind of take a business-as-usual approach to the, you know, every couple of years we kind of have a conflict and tit-for-tat, and then we pick ourselves up again and we wait another 2 years and do it all over again, that kind of pattern was unsustainable. And it was unsustainable in no small part because we cannot afford to be expending these things. We can't be having our missile defense assets, radars and such destroyed in the conflict, because frankly, we need these things to, for what we say is the pacing threat for China. And, you know, we had to move Patriot batteries from South Korea and Japan to the Middle East for this exercise. And who knows what else had to, you know, pivot back out of the Pacific. So my earnest hope is that, that this will be seen through to the end, and that in addition to sinking the Navy and obliterate and you know, doing whatever we need to do on the ground on the nuclear program, but no kidding, ending the missile program once and for all. You know, this the going back to the JCPOA, you know, from 15 years ago or whatever it was, you know, it was a debate at the time about, well, hey, it doesn't include the missile program. But, you know, it was felt at the time that that was an acceptable trade. But where we are now is it's just not anymore. And so I think going after the missiles is absolutely necessary. So in terms of hardware being used, frankly, I'm also scared of finding out just how many Tomahawks or JASMs or other long-range strike weapons that we've expended. I expect it will be a significant number. Now, I will say I breathed a sigh of relief when there were two words uttered by General Kane, the chairman, and those two words were munitions transition, which is to say, he said, we're transitioning from having to use those long-range standoff capabilities to now being able to operate with stand-in weapons. So think gravity bombs, JDAMs, and SDBs. Well, that's great news because we've got a lot of them. They're still precision-guided munitions, but it's they're not nearly as scarce as these other ones. So that's, I think, the most important thing. I've seen, I think it was Reuters reported, and they threw out some numbers of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones have been intercepted. And actually, the intercept rate was very high. You know, it's actually, especially on the ballistic missile side, very, very few not being intercepted. More so on the Shahed drone. You know, we've seen the videos and things like that. That's frankly a function of they're harder to detect to some extent. But also, even if you could detect them magically from space and you had perfect awareness, the nature of the trajectory is such, and the nature of their altitude trajectory is such, that your defense really needs to be close to your defended asset, and that makes it by its nature point defense kind of a problem. And the thing about that is that you can't have defenses everywhere all the time, and so you have to be picky about what you defend. And you know, some of the casualties and the damage that has been done, I strongly suspect is because there weren't defenses there in the first place, and that may have been a rational, calculated choice to have defenses somewhere else as opposed to most of these places. So you know, those are the things that come to mind off the top of my head. Again, these are measured in hundreds and potentially thousands of drones so far of significant size. I mean, when we're talking about Shaheds, we're really talking about cruise missiles, 900, over 2,000 kilometers range, ostensibly. That's some serious legs, and I think that merits being called a cruise missile as opposed to a UAV or loitering munition or what have you.
Yeah, I think the last several years have really challenged our default taxonomies for some of these things, and that's a perfect example. You mentioned Marco Rubio's comments that this is largely about the missile program. But when we talk about targeting Iran's missile program, what are we talking about? Because, you know, Iran fields a large number of short-range ballistic missiles, medium-range ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. As you argued, the drones that they're firing right now should probably be considered effectively as cruise missiles. Are there signs that certain of these weapons are being prioritized for targeting?
Well, I don't know about signs, but that seems certainly a very reasonable surmise. And the fact that, well, we don't know yet exactly what has been fired and what has been intercepted. And I would be a little surprised if that does come out, frankly. I'm sure we know, but I'd be a little surprised if it comes out in terms of this many of this type missile. But who knows? The most important thing for me is the flattening of the curve. in terms of the rate of missile launches by Iran. And that just tells me, again, that we are, through whatever combination of activities, bombing the missile cities, finding the launchers, destroying the launchers, destroying the missiles themselves, whatever it is, that as of yesterday or the day before, it had been an 86% reduction in the daily count. So it's definitely flattening the curve of the cumulative launches. And that's a very good sign.
Iran came out and said, I believe in the first few days of the conflict, that it was using principally older weapon systems, which implied, I think, that maybe it was holding back some more capable weapons in reserve. Is there any evidence that that's true?
Hard to know. I mean, I think it might be a little bit, it's a little hard to understand the logic of holding it back when it would seem to be the intentions of the United States are fairly clear. So it's a little bit hard to think that. I mean, but on the other hand, look, President Trump also said that we have the big one hasn't even come yet. So who knows what that's a reference to, if it's something real. So it's also entirely possible to just be talk. But, knowing that the United States is going to find ways to suppress your launchers, to find them and destroy them, it might be a little bit of a surprise. But on the other hand, I mean, look, we've already taken out a lot of the leadership, or I guess the Israelis have taken out a lot of the leadership. But that would be a little bit of a surprise.
You mentioned the cost imbalance between enemy effectors and our own interceptors. That's an important element of this operation. It's also an important element of the kind of broader counter-drone discussion that's getting a lot of attention right now. But it's also not really new, at least in the sense that, that's effectively been the case for the last quarter century during U.S. military operations in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. We've been spending way more on our weapon systems than our adversaries have on theirs. There's also sort of emerged over the past decade or more, maybe, this kind of comparative framework between, on one side, weapons that are expensive and exquisite, and as a consequence, things that we have a finite number of in our arsenal, On the other side, you've got cheap, less sophisticated, and much more plentiful types of weapons. The U.S. sort of way of war has long had a pretty intense bias in favor of the former, right? The expensive and the exquisite. So I wonder if you think it's noteworthy then that the U.S. military has reportedly used the Lucas, which is, effectively a U.S. equivalent of Iran's Shahed drone during this operation.
Yeah. In terms of the Lucas drone or cruise missile that was used, I think there's a certain poetic justice about it. We reverse engineered it ahead and sent it back to them. So it's kind of fun, if nothing else, as well as an experiment, of course, and as well as perhaps a pilot for future things. There's plenty of other low-cost cruise missiles floating around in terms of concepts and otherwise. So don't necessarily need to go that direction, although the reported cost of something like $30,000 is pretty dang cheap, to be sure. Having said that, I'm going to be a little bit of a curmudgeon that we wouldn't be where we are today if we had if we didn't have all those exquisite platforms and exquisite systems that you were talking about. We would have eaten a lot of missile attacks. We would not have been able to probably suppress the things that we did in the very quickly during the conflict. And, I just don't think we would have been able to have the standoff capability that, of course, we do, as well as the, certainly the very exquisite aircraft, air power kind of thing. But I also want to be a little bit contrarian on the low cost as an alternative thing. I mean, if there is one headline, John, that we've both seen more than anyone else, or one phrase, it is the tedious cliche that we're using a $4 million missile against a $40,000 drone. How many times have we seen that? It's clickbait, and it drives me bananas, because for the most part, it's just not true. So what that's a reference to is the unit cost, the all-around cost of a Patriot, specifically a PAC-3 MSE. And It is true that on occasion, Patriots have been used against drones, say in an emergency, to which I would say that's not necessarily a bad thing. And this is where you get into cost versus value. But what really bugs me is that, and this is, I think, maybe a reflection of the popular lack of understanding of what's going on in the air defense world, or what's going on in the SHORAD world and the counter UAS world, is we've got a lot of stuff, and there are, you talk about taxonomies. I'm talking about taxonomies all the time. Nobody seems to know what's below a Patriot, and to some extent, that's because, you know, we won the Cold War and decided that air superiority was an American birthright, and we didn't need that anymore. But over the past decade or so, there's been a kind of a renaissance. SHORAD. Now, we're not doing nearly enough on the SHORAD piece. Army SHORAD has kind of fallen off, as you know, in the past couple of years. And I suspect we may see a bit of a revitalization of SHORAD here coming up. But the effectors that are coming off for the SHORAD mission, they're not $4 million Patriots. And we have likewise our LID system, and the Marines have the MRIC system. And the MRIC is using the Israeli Tamir, essentially, for its program, and the LIDS program, mobile LIDS, fixed LIDS, you know, lower tier intercept defensive system. It's using the Coyote, right? Coyote doesn't. It's an order of magnitude or more than order of magnitude less. And so this is where I think the UAS threat is ubiquitous, and I hope that we will now see a surge in the production of the counter UAS capabilities. And hopefully in the trail of that, we might just get a little bit more understanding that, you know, for the vast majority of these things are not being taken out by Patriots. They're probably being taken out by one of these other lower tier system or gun-based systems. A lot of the drones in Ukraine, now Ukraine was shooting at things with Patriots earlier on, and they pretty quickly figured out that they need to steward those scarce strategic resources. And so a lot of the UASs are taken out by one or another kind of EW or drones or something else. And we've seen a lot of videos on that. So I think maybe it's too much to hope, but I do hope that in the fullness of time, we'll stop seeing those cliches. We've got to have the $4 million missiles, because you could fill the sky with, you know, really cheap counter UAS effectors. You could throw up 1,000 of them and not have the capability of a single PAC-3. And so this is where I think the conversation really needs just a little bit of a kick in the pants, is these cliches, these phrases that are being thrown around, I think are really misleading. That if it was that easy to take out a ballistic missile with a cheap, attritable bauble, we would have figured it out by now. As it turns out, some of these intercept missions are pretty dang hard. And for those, you do need the higher end stuff. And it would be quite painful, for instance, if Israel had taken 500 ballistic missile attacks, you know, area the size of New Jersey, had taken 500 ballistic missile attacks. I think in some respects we've really taken for granted that benefit.
So maybe to close out, I wonder if you have any thoughts about what integrated air defense looks like in a context like this one. In its sort of perfect form, you know, integrated air defense means weapon systems with overlapping ranges, sensors that overlap to give maximum coverage. What are the challenges of trying to do that, trying to establish integrated air defense in a region, you know, I guess covering lots of pieces of different states' territory?
Yeah, well, this has been a conversation for, you know, for forever, for 20 years, in terms of how do we get at least some greater degree of interoperability between and among countries that, and this is not unique to the Middle East, but between and among countries that don't trust each other necessarily year to year. There've been some political, you know, ups and downs between, let's say, Qatar and Saudi, for instance. But I suspect that there has been sufficient interoperability put together, and at any rate, the intercept rates, the reported intercept rates for the past week have been looking pretty good. Now, what may be less obvious is whether a lack of interoperability and a lack of information sharing resulted in an overexpenditure of interceptors fired. That would be a very unfortunate but quite plausible consequence of insufficient interoperability. For the most part, I think that, for instance, the shot into Turkey, right? That may or may not benefit from some GCC information, right? There's just lots of disparate, to some extent, largely localized problems. So it's a perennial desire. We're always looking for better information sharing. We're always looking for more interoperability. But we'll see.
Ultimately, that challenge of integrated air defense isn't really just about positioning defensive, you know, effectors, interceptors, radars, and other sensors. It's also about connecting them all together. So, you know, broadly speaking, this is a network problem. In a context like this one, involving so many different states, is that the fundamental challenge of integrated air defense, sort of building that shared network so that all of the pieces can be plugged into the same system?
Well, my missile defense project team at CSS is actually working on a report on, no kidding, what is the meaning or what are the meanings of integration when we talk about integrated air and missile defense? And the short answer is there's not one meaning. It's one of those things, it's a bit of a Rorschach test that when people say, oh, we need more integration so that the systems can talk to each other better. Well, for what purpose? And what do you mean by talk? And is it talking in one direction or is the conversation back and forth? When we say that machines are talking to each other, do we mean that one is commanding the other or directing the other? And so there are many, many functions in the air defense kill chain. And I think that is probably the beginning of wisdom to sharpening our vocabulary about the meaning of integrated air and missile defense is to try to be a little bit more specific of what is the thing that you want to accomplish? Is it early warning? Is it cueing? Like just saying, hey, something is headed your way. Focus your radar energy to this quadrant in the sky, right? Like that could be a really useful thing. And you could do that with not the greatest or tightest form of integration. So really a functional-based approach here, I think, is perhaps useful.
Well, Tom, I'm conscious of the time, and your expertise is very much in demand right now, even more so than usual. So I will leave it at that, and I want to thank you for making time to speak to me today.
Well, hey, thank you, John. Enjoy listening to the podcast, and enjoy being on the podcast, and thanks for what you do.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.